Shrink Wrap Radio Number 321, The Brain in Trauma and PTSD, with Robert Scare, MD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is neurologist Dr. Robert Scare, and we'll be discussing his new book, Eight Keys to Brain-Body Balance. Robert Scare, MD, received his BA in psychology and his MD degree at the University of Rochester. He is board certified in neurology and has been in practice for 36 years, 20 of those as medical director of rehabilitation services at the Mapleton Center in Boulder, Colorado. His primary areas of interest and expertise have been in the fields of traumatic brain injury and chronic pain, and more recently in the study of traumatic stress and its role in physical and emotional symptoms and diseases. He has lectured extensively on these topics and has published several articles on post-traumatic stress disorder, dissociation, the whiplash syndrome, and other somatic syndromes of traumatic stress. He's published three books, the first, The Body Bears the Burden, Trauma, Dissociation, and Disease, presenting a new theory of dissociation and its role in many diseases. A second edition of this book was released in October 2007. A second book, The Trauma Spectrum, Hidden Wounds and Human Resiliency, addresses the broad and relatively unappreciated spectrum of cultural and societal trauma that shapes every aspect of our lives. A third book, Eight Keys to the Brain-Body Balance, released in October 2012, is geared to a lay audience, providing a practical understanding of the physiology of the brain-body interface and its role in healing stress and trauma. He's currently retired from clinical medical practice and continues to pursue a career in writing and lecturing in the field of traumatology. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Robert Scare, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. And you are a neurologist. And first of all, I have to comment on the fact that your last name is Scare.
Right.
That sounds like it would have been a handicap.
it caused a lot of laughter.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You don't scare me. My nickname was Scarecrow when I was a kid. So, yeah, I've lived with it. It's been more humorous than a burden.
I've always been amazed by, and I think others have noticed this, the weird, sometimes, correspondence between a person's name and their profession. For example, I had a dentist named Dr. Bridges. That's, you know, that's just one example that comes to mind. And Dr. Scare, certainly, I'm going to add that to my list. Thank goodness you weren't a dentist, though.
Well, I know some Dr. Paynes who are dentists.
So. Oh, yes, right. Okay. Well, what made you decide to become a neurologist?
I had a mentor during my internship who was a British neurologist from what's called Queen's Square, which is one of the top neurology study places. It's in London, actually. And he was extremely delightful, charismatic, and brilliant. And I'm a little bit of an egghead and a nerd of my life. And I was fascinated by the way that he used the physical examination to figure out where the problem was in the brain. And he did it brilliantly and with very clever tools. And I had this wonderful experience, 3 months on a neurology rotation, and I signed up for the residency.
Well, you can't discount the power of the charismatic teacher, that person who brings something alive. And I think so many of us changed our major or, you know, made some major commitment as a result of an inspiring teacher.
This was directly resulting from that, no question about it.
Yeah. Now, in your preface, I was intrigued to notice that you say you've been influenced by your neighbor, Peter Levine, who's done He's done a lot of work on trauma, and I recently interviewed Maggie Phillips, who do you know her as well?
Oh, extremely well. I've done two radio workshops with her, a 2-day workshop at a meeting. So, yeah, I know Maggie very well.
Oh, that's great. Well, I interviewed her here recently, so it's a small world. I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions about trauma, so don't shoot the whole wad right here. But what can you tell us? What can you tell us about, sort of in general, about his influence on your work?
Well, I'll tell you the brief history of my hearing of him, meeting him, and then having him treat some of my staff in a demonstration, and then having him demonstrate his work with me. I was a medical director of a rehabilitation center for 20 years called the Mapleton Center in Boulder. I dealt with a lot of patients with early disabilities, with injuries, strokes, and disabling events in their lives. I particularly saw dozens and dozens of auto accident victims with what's called whiplash syndrome. Mm-hmm. Because we had a brain injury program and a chronic pain program, both of which I directed for portions of that 20 years. And so I had this, I'd probably see 2 to 3 new auto accident victims a week. And it was a very strange problem. The medical field looks at whiplash with askance. It doesn't make sense to them. And of course it doesn't in the model that they use. But they all had the same symptoms, which suggests that something was the same about the injury and the experience. A lot of them were depressed, and a lot of them had post-traumatic stress disorder. And in 1997, I believe, one of my therapists in the program gave me an article by Levine. I read it, and I thought, my God, he's describing all these whiplash victims.
Mm, interesting.
And he's describing me in parts of my life. Because, you know, this problem is pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So I invited him to give a little demonstration, morning lecture and demo with some of my therapists, which he did, and two of them had chronic persisting pain from an injury, one from back surgery, one from dislocated shoulder. And he did his little thing with them, which was so subtle I really couldn't figure out what he was doing. But he had them do some body tracking and imagery and stuff like that, and they came out of it feeling a little better. And over the next few days, both of them, the pain was mostly gone. So I sent some patients to him, and several of my chronic patients came back from two or three sessions with him and said, I don't know what that guy does. my pain's gone.
Wow, that's
my
remarkable.
Brain injury's gone. So wow. I called Levine. I said, Peter, show me what you do. I went down out to Lyons, about 10 miles from Boulder, and he did this session with me. It was about 2 hours long. It involved subtle things, observations of me on a balance board, having me scan body sensations. It was very subtle. But at one point he had me lie down, and he had his hand under my left shoulder. Of course, what he'd been doing was looking at what my body was doing when I was standing on this balance beam, because he could see parts of my body that weren't in sync. Very interesting. And so I lay there as he guided me, and pretty soon I started to feel my left forehead twitch and a little tingly sensation around my left eye. And then my face started to contort, and pretty soon my body curled up into this contorted posture on my left side. And I thought, but three things. One, I'm not doing this. My brain's doing it. It's not my intention. Mm-hmm. This is something that medical science doesn't know anything about, whatever this is. And my God, it's from my old eye injury at age 4.
Wow.
And my body went into the self-protection movement that it had done 60 years before, when I lost my left eye in an accident. It curled up into the self-protective pattern. I realized, my God, this is what I did when I was a child. And I never remembered the movement, but the movement was there for 60 years. And afterwards, I sweated, and it was an autonomic response. I was freezing, and I was sweating, and it was quite bizarre. And I went home that night. I slept for about 9 hours. Next day I got up, and over the next few days I noted that the little tick that I had on the left side of my face and eye had disappeared. I had a tick all my life.
Yeah, wow.
Eye-clenching tick. So the tick disappeared. So I this was an epiphany.
I would say so, yeah.
That no other doctor knew. I thought also it was like what I was familiar with, conversion hysteria, which is a psychosomatic pattern of movement that neurologists are very familiar with, because
sure.
I saw dozens of hysteric patients. Well, this was, I also thought, this is conversion hysteria. Now, I had not had any of this before, but it's the same phenomenon. So I started to read. I read his books. I read everything he wrote. I got a book by Bessel van der Kolk about trauma. It was the best-known book on trauma back in the 90s. And I read the whole thing, and I realized, and I began to realize that whiplash was an experience, not a physical injury. These patients, like me, had stored the movement patterns of that accident in their unconscious memory. And somehow it got stuck there, and all of their symptoms reflected all of these sensations and movement patterns that occurred in the accident.
That's interesting, because there are, this goes at least as far back as Wilhelm Reich, who asserted that emotional issues were locked in our body.
Yeah, of course, and he was absolutely right.
Yeah. What a dramatic story, and I had intended to, PTSD is a theme that pretty much runs throughout the book, so, and I think I understand why now, just based on the story that you've shared us, and so I'll be asking you a lot of specific questions as we go along, and...
Since you've said PTSD, let me just clarify what I think about that. Okay. I don't think I may have mentioned PTSD once or twice. PTSD is the tip of the iceberg. It's what we see. But beneath it is this incredibly complex structure of the trauma. And PTSD is only a tiny portion of the symptom complex, which explains all of these body sensations and body phenomenology, which aren't included in the diagnosis of PTSD. So, anyway, go ahead with your question.
Okay, well, actually, that sparks a different, I don't know if it's a question or an observation. I was recently at a conference, an International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, and somebody got up and made a comment or asked a question that, and I wish I knew who he was, but he was so authoritative in what he said that, from the audience, that I suspect he really knew what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And he made the observation that nobody has come up with a long-term solution for PTSD. Now, I interview so many people who claim to have come up with a solution for PTSD. And so those two are kind of fighting in my mind.
Well, I think there are solutions, but no complete cures. Mm-hmm. No complete cures. The trouble is that PTSD is based on the retention in unconscious memory, procedural memory, of all of the events, the sensory and motor events of the trauma. And they keep coming back and coming back with cues in the environment that relate to the experience, like a rape or an auto accident or whatever, or warfare. And so that everything keeps recurring over and over again because it's a process stored in memory. Well, you have to, and it's stored there by classical conditioning, just like a dog salivating at the bell when a bell is rung with feeding. This is classical conditioning. They call it fear conditioning. And so if one uses techniques that involve extinction, in other words, exposing them to the cue, in the absence of threat, gradually all these elements will be extinguished. And I think the trouble with therapy that for PTSD that's been done, exposure, cognitive behavioral, all of these, is they don't include extinguishing the body memories, for instance, that cause whiplash syndrome.
Well, I would think that CBT would do just that, that they would have the person be in a state of deep relaxation, imagine the whiplash situation, and sort of keep doing a successive approximations of that experience until they can mentally review it without arousal.
But I didn't mentally review my situation. Mm-hmm. It was an unconscious body response.
Mm-hmm.
And that extinguished all those procedural memories for what my body tried to do unsuccessfully to protect me.
Okay.
And I think that's the critical issue in trauma, is incorporating the somatic manifestations, experiences, sensations, and movement patterns that accompanied the trauma. And cognitive behavioral and those other types of therapies tend not to do that.
Okay.
What Levine writes about in his books, of course, is extinguishing the body memories through completion of the event. In other words, replication of the act of self-defense in a safe setting, which is what I did. And I went on to have about 40 sessions of somatic experiencing, which got rid of all the cricks in my neck, all of the stuff that I always took for granted as being part of me. They weren't. They were part of this event. But it required my body going through that pattern to do it. And that's more Reiki than anything else. But that's not part of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Okay.
And as a result, Levine is not well respected in the psychiatry community because it's alien. It's totally alien to the concepts that psychologists and psychiatrists are taught. It's a neurophysiological phenomenon. And so I approach this from the brain solely, not from psyche or anything like that. I approach this as a neurologist, and that's the difference.
Yeah, now the brain, of course, is a very complex topic. Who did you have in mind when you wrote your book, Eight Keys to Brain-Body Balance? What's the audience?
This is a book specifically written for the intelligent lay audience.
Okay.
People who are interested in how the brain works, people who have suffered stress and trauma, and they're two different things. And the diseases or syndromes of them, and I give them a primer manual on how the brain works in some detail, but in simplified language, and then I correlate it with the effects of negative life experience, stress and trauma, how that changes the things that I've educated them about, and then how that provides a substrate for healing through the body-based therapies that I write about at the end of the book.
Yeah. Now, did you, in fact, yourself become an administrator of this or a practitioner of this kind of therapy?
No. In those days, I was directing a rehab center. I didn't have time to be a therapist.
Okay.
I was a psychology major in college, but I don't have psychotherapy training. But I eventually, every time that one of these techniques came out, like Peter Levine's somatic experiencing and EMDR and all of these, I studied those and I tried to figure out the brain models that explained how and why they worked.
Yes, that was one of the things that struck me too, is that you mentioned EMDR and I think EFT, emotional freedom
yes.
technique, some of the tapping techniques. And
yes.
And I think you initially were skeptical. I know I was initially skeptical. I know that EMDR actually has been subjected to quite a bit of research. And,
oh, yeah.
And you were able to kind of posit at least some ideas about how the brain might be functioning to allow those to be effective.
Yeah, I gradually assimilated the facts that led to that because I obviously read voraciously. Anytime you write a book, you read 50 books. It educates you wonderfully. So
yeah.
I picked up everybody's ideas about this. And then I began to put it together, and part of it came from a shamanic journey that I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the shaman are the healers in a tribe, and they incorporate somatic techniques to heal trauma. That's what the rituals of shamanism are. And I analyzed what the shamanic content of behavior was, and it was very much like many of these techniques that that have arisen serendipitously, like Francine Shapiro's experience with the birds, figuring out when she moved her eyes quickly, detuned her arousal system. So I really kind of came to realize that so many of these things that are done for healing through ages have to do with extinguishing the memories of a traumatic event and clearing the field.
That's fascinating, and I totally agree with you about the importance of understanding something about shamanic approaches that we don't just dismiss those, you know, as some kind of primitive pre-medical stuff. Where did you get exposed to that? I'm just curious.
Well, one of my therapists at the Mapleton Center was Brazilian, and I actually introduced her to somatic experiencing, and she spent time with Levine, learned it, became a practitioner of, and she was an occupational therapist who worked with kids with attention disorder and autism in the pediatric program at my rehab center. And we subsequently have gone on to put together a series of workshops, three-day workshops, and we've traveled all over the world giving these workshops, emphasizing some of the things from her OT background having to do with what's called sensory processing disorder, which is a childhood syndrome, but which extends into adulthood, which is post-traumatic. It's related to early pre-verbal trauma. So, and she invited me to visit a shaman that she worked with, actually, in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of us went down there and spent 10 days in this shamanic journey.
Okay. Well, you certainly, I have to applaud you for having a very open mind. I think more so than is often attributed to MDs.
Well, I've always been a bit of a rebel, but I've also had this insatiable curiosity.
Yeah, well, that's a great trait to have.
Yeah.
Now, let's see here. The book is called Eight Keys, and so maybe you could just kind of quickly just give us the quick outline of not even go into them, but just tell us what the eight keys are, and then we'll dig deeper into some of them.
Yeah, the eight key series is that it's a way of containing a book into a specific structure for lay people about issues related to psychology and psychopathology. So I basically fitted my topics into eight keys based on the education I wanted to give with regarding to the brain and then its application to stress and trauma. First key was the brain and body message systems, how the brain and body can communicate with each other. Then organizing sensations and movement, which are the things one perceives and the things that one does with the message system. Then I talk about the autonomic nervous system, which is very critical to trauma because trauma is a cyclical dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system to a great extent. And that is the vegetative unconscious system that runs our body. And I talk about the emotional brain or limbic system because that's the part of the brain that processes trauma. It is how we manage emotions. Then I talk about brain plasticity because the brain changes for better or for worse based on information. And there's tremendous amount of new interest in research in the fact that the brain is changing physically and chemically and electrically with our experiences. And that has specifically to do with how trauma evolves. Then I talk about the brain and stress and trauma and the effects of that on the body. And that's key 7. And then key 8 is how to heal the wounded brain and body.
Okay. Well, the first four keys or chapters set up a lot of the background in terms of brain function and control. But let's skip over those here and drill down a bit on the last four chapters. Would that be okay?
Yes. Yeah, it all leads up to that.
Yeah, so in chapter 5, you mentioned that you were taught 40 years ago or so in medical school that the brain's allotment of neurons is fixed at birth. And I think I was taught the same thing in physiological psychology in about the same time frame. But you say that story has changed.
It's changed dramatically. Over the past, I'd say, 20 to 30 years, it started back in the 70s and 80s, but it's changed dramatically in recent years. And now you'll see articles in Science and New York Times about brain plasticity frequently. It's a very appealing subject, and it's a very exciting subject from the standpoint of what we can do about things regarding our brain, including damage like strokes and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, I was one of the things that intrigued me is that, in fact, we have heard a lot about the plasticity of the brain lately. For example, in terms of the ability to recover from brain injuries and strokes and so on.
Yeah.
And so we've kind of come to look at plasticity as a positive thing. But you say plasticity can be for better or worse. How so?
Yes. Well, trauma, which is basically a life threat in the face of helplessness, my definition of trauma. Trauma freezes the person in that moment in parts of the brain that perceived what went on. All of the sensory organs that perceived movement patterns, all of the actual contractions of muscles for self-protection, all of that stuff is stored in its exact replicable form in a way that changes the brain. And that's for life. I mean, the untreated trauma victim will always have problems regarding those functions which are locked into our memory. And if you looked at brain maps, you can do that now with functional MRIs and a variety of magnetic encephalography, you'll see that parts of the brain have shrunken and parts have expanded and parts have increased blood flow and parts decreased blood flow related to these memories, literally, memories have changed the structure of the brain.
Okay. There's a kind of new mantra about the brain that I encountered in your book, and it's one I've heard elsewhere, namely that neurons that fire together wire together.
Yes.
So how does that play with what you were just saying?
Well, if you have, this is a way of operating it. It's not necessarily the things that make it happen that way. But if you are exposed to information, or you're trying to learn a skill, it will activate certain parts of the brain. And then it will begin to spread to other adjacent parts of the brain that have similar but a little bit of different functions. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see is that part of the brain will enlarge. Primarily because new synapses are being formed and new axons and dendrites are being formed. New connections are being formed between cells in the brain. And so the white matter will expand. The connective tissue in the brain is white matter. Mm-hmm. And actually neurons will replicate and grow. So if, for instance, you perform complex memory games, the hippocampus, the part of the brain that stores memory, will enlarge, actually physically enlarge in size, number of neurons, and number of connections.
Yeah, I was really struck by that, and I was interested to read that the hippocampus is particularly susceptible to plasticity, which is what you just said. And somehow that's related to dreaming, a topic I'm very interested in. So tell us about that connection with dreams.
Well, dreams, dreams, you rest, restore your energy somehow. It's kind of a generic term. But in fact, dreams are inevitable and critical. And there are about 7 cycles of rapid eye movement or dream sleep per night, each one getting closer and closer until you're awake. During those dreams, what's happening is the brain is consolidating the memory information stored in the hippocampus from that day's experiences that have emotional content. In other words, those that are positive emotions or threat or stress. And the brain will then integrate that information into its storehouse of learned information for future use because it has survival implications. So this is how we learn to survive, is storing the day's lessons in our brain through dream sleep. And of course, if the messages are like old messages, you'll have something that's familiar from your past, all tied up in a crazy illogical way with something that's happened that day. But it's doing that in order to incorporate whatever the brain had to learn to survive into our bank of survival memory.
Yeah. Now, you say a good night's sleep is essential for effective memory consolidation. What does that say? Yeah. What does that say about the tendency of students to pull all-nighters, cramming for a test the next day?
It's the most counterintuitive thing you can do. You'll hold that information very briefly. You won't store it very long, because as you go through your night sleeping, the dreams come faster and faster. So the later portions of your sleep are when the storage is really cemented. And so what you're doing is depriving the brain of that capacity to store all that critical information you're trying to learn.
Well, luckily, I was never hardy enough to pull an all-nighter. I just couldn't stay up, and I just thought, well, you know, to me, my sleep felt more important, although I had no theoretical structure to base that on.
Right. I was the same way. I was a nerd anyway, so I knew how to study, but I must have realized that instinctively, if I didn't sleep, the way I felt the next day was counteractive with regards to learning anything.
Yeah. Talk to us a bit, if you will, about genetics, epigenetics, and trauma.
Epigenetics is very complex. The epigenome was discovered quite some years ago, maybe in the 80s. And the epigenome, I always thought it was a structure, but it's not. It is a system at the tip of the gene which responds to things that happen in the environment. And it is shaped by experience. And the fact that genes, it will have the potential to switch on or off the gene that it is influencing. And that introduces a whole new concept of genetics, in that genetics aren't just a life sentence, but that life sentence is a proclivity, perhaps, but it's also based on any negative experiences or positive ones that may switch on certain genes or switch off other genes.
What about our thoughts and attitudes? Might those also be releasing or suppressing factors in terms of this epigenetic theory?
Yeah. Well, you know, thoughts and attitudes, they occur de novo, but they also occur in response to environmental stimuli, perhaps to a greater degree. Mm-hmm. So environmental stimuli will create our thoughts, and our thoughts will change our epigenomes. And most specifically, if these are negative events, they will change the genomes on genes that control our emotional brain, including the genomes that affect autism and the autism spectrum, probably schizophrenia. In other words, the major so-called genetic mental illnesses, bipolar disorder, are probably susceptible to being switched on or off by negative life experience early life, in infancy. And that of course, shakes up the whole idea of, for instance, the epidemic of autism that we're experiencing in this country. Is this an epidemic of autism related to something that's switching on genes? And if so, what would it be? Well, it would be negative life experience. In other words, negative experience during early childhood. So when you have an epidemic of this sort of a gene-related mental disorder, you need to look at the culture and see if something in the culture is causing this switching on of the epigenome for this gene disorder.
Well, that's an interesting thought. I don't know where it takes you. The first place my mind goes when I hear that is to think that kids probably don't get nearly as much face time with parents as they used to, and maybe this comes along too later, but kids can't go out and play anymore in the neighborhood like they used to.
Those
are a couple of things that come to my mind. What do you think of when you think of how is the environment different that we would have an upsurge of these kinds of problems?
Well, I came across Alan Shore's work very early on. I met him as I was just getting into this. Alan Shore has written three books on early infant attunement and bonding. This goes back to the work by Bowlby in the 1980s and 90s on maternal infant bonding.
Mm-hmm.
And Shore presents a neurophysiological structure for this. What parts of the brain are operating in the process of a mother and an infant connecting? And what are the implications for the connection being never made adequately? And he quotes evidence that the part of the brain that controls and modulates our emotions, it's called the orbitofrontal cortex on the right side, grows in the face of attunement and shrinks in the face of malattunement or impaired connection between the mother and infant.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and what his premise is, and there's a huge volume of literature on this now, is that in the infant who's not attuned, they are subjected to a life of dysregulation of their autonomic nervous system and their emotional brain. And could that be the switch, the epigenetic switch, that's causing our social epidemic? If so, we need to look at what we're doing in the first month or two of life.
Yeah, yeah.
What's happening? Well, what we have is daycare.
Yeah, yeah.
And a 40% C-section rate,
mm-hmm.
Which renders the mother impaired as far as her attunement capacity, because C-sections are very painful, and the recovery is difficult. Like any major surgery. Anyway, this is speculation. This is kind of a social speculation, but there are people, and I'm not the only one saying this, who think that this may be a cultural phenomenon that is creating this dilemma.
That's fascinating, and it's very exciting that we're these relationships that we're beginning to understand in so much more depth, particularly the relationships between what's going on in the brain and how that interacts with culture and with other aspects of our lives. I was really interested in a phenomenon that you reported that I guess somebody else has studied among Holocaust survivors.
Yes.
That you say suggests that traumatic memories might actually be passed along in the genes. I'd never heard that.
There are a variety of ways to interpret the statistics, but the Holocaust studies now are three generations old, and there is no question there's a dramatic incidence of PTSD, but also the personality disorders and diseases, physical diseases that are related to early life trauma. Now, is this due to the fact that the genes that control this are epigenetically changed by the horrible experience of the mother, which is then passed on to the children?
So you're talking about the children and the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors.
Yes. Now, could it be that patterns of behavior are changed by virtue of the trauma that the mother has experienced, that she is unable to bond because of the effect on her brain of the terrible trauma she's had? Or is it transcripting genes that have to do with personality, with character and personality development, which a lot of people feel is more based on experience than just the genes themselves? So that's an incredibly complex issue, and one that's very sensitive as well, I think, from the standpoint of blame, because we're not talking about blame in this. We're talking about inevitability.
You know, I couldn't help reading about that. I couldn't help wondering if this might add some credibility to Carl Jung's theory of the collective unconscious as stemming from genetic memory.
I think it could well. I talk about some of that where, even in the Swedish studies, the grandfather, having lived in deprivation and starving, resulted in increased heart disease in his grandsons, which yeah. the study showed. I mean, this is so complex, blending the effects of genetic transcription with the effects of behavioral availability. In other words, the ability to bond, and I talk about that with the social engagement system. Stephen Porges, all another topic which I address.
I got to interview him, too, by the way.
Yeah, well, his work, Polyvagal Theory, is absolutely, it's like Shore. It's groundbreaking.
Yes.
Definitely groundbreaking.
Yes. Let's move on to Chapter 6. I don't know if we'll make it all the way through on the brain and stress and trauma. And one of the things you talk about there is stress versus trauma. And you say those are two different states and two different responses.
Coexist. They coexist, and one may morph into the other. Stress is basically the response of the autonomic and the endocrine systems to threat. When there is a threat, which can be either stress or life-threatening, it activates the sympathetic nervous system through the hypothalamus and then through the endocrine system, the pituitary. And the pituitary system regulates the release of cortisol by the adrenal cortex. And everybody knows about cortisol is the stress hormone these days. And cortisol, it prepares the person or the animal for prolonged threat. How to deal with a prolonged threat that's not life-threatening in the moment where you have to go fight and flight, but you are in danger, prolonged danger. And that requires you to gear up your systems that provide energy resources, especially glucose. And so your cholesterol goes up, your blood sugar goes up, your blood pressure goes up because you retain water, because you want to keep your blood volume high in case you lose blood. It does all these things that allow you to manage the danger in the short term. But if you're stuck with high cortisol for a long time, you get complications of all these adaptive measures.
Yeah, it becomes chronic, right?
And
it makes chronic changes to the brain.
Yeah, well, chronic changes in the brain, actually it shrinks the hippocampus. Cortisol is toxic to the hippocampus, and so you get cognitive problems and emotional problems.
Wow.
But you get hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, atherosclerosis, because of the effects on the body systems of high levels of glucose, high levels of cortisol, and increased blood volume. So it's very hard on you.
Yeah, what do you think about meditation as an antidote for that?
I think meditation is an antidote to all of these things, because what meditation is turning off, it's turning off the monkey brain. It's turning off the issues in your life that haven't been resolved and that involve negative implications, which is the definition of stress. And all these little things that that go over and over and over in our minds at times when we can't turn them off, they imply something dangerous is going on, a threat. If one can clear the mind, and the techniques mainly involve breath work.
Yes.
If you can calm the mind through breath work, you will shut down that part of the brain that causes this chronic low-level arousal. It's very hard to do. I've developed a meditation practice, and I've been doing it about 5 years, and I still have to work at it.
Yes,
very hard to do.
Right,
because ruminations that we call always have to do with a conflict, and we haven't resolved, which means they're just about to be trauma, a threat in the face of helplessness, and so they're hard on the body too, but. With the breath work, you incorporate the Porges' ventral vagal, the part of the vagus nerve that promotes homeostasis. And so breath work helps you to modulate this stress response. Conscious breath work will bring down the arousal system and produce a period of homeostasis. And so you're healing not only the body but the brain during that period of time when you were in that state of presence and breath awareness?
Wow, that of course makes me marvel that in yoga, you know, they have this pranayama practice that's probably 1,000 or more years old.
Oh yeah. Well, the ancients knew a lot.
Yeah, right.
They didn't have all the science, but they had the logic and they had the experience and they recognized things for what they were.
Yeah,
it's like shamanism. There's a lot of truth in these practices that is ancient, arrived at through trial and error over hundreds of over thousands of years, literally. And there's meaning to these things.
In this chapter, you do talk about Peter Levine and the freeze response and the shaking.
Yes, right.
That's become an important part of his approach. Maybe you could kind of say a little bit about that.
That concept of the freeze response is the core of trauma, as far as I'm concerned. Trauma is an unresolved, undischarged, uncompleted freeze response. I have a polar bear video from National Geographic that I show, showing a polar bear who's been shot by a dart to immobilize him so they can tag him to look at migration patterns. And as he comes out of the fog of the shot, he begins to shake and tremble all over, and if you run it in slow motion, he's running. So he's doing what my left side did when I was with Levine. He was completing the act of escape. He was replicating the motor patterns that were truncated or aborted by the injection of the sedative.
So we talk about fight or flight. It sounds like there's a third possibility here, which is neither fight or flight, it's freeze.
And freeze is physiological. It protects the prey animal sometimes, because sometimes movement cues trigger the attack of the predator. But it also is an innate part of our physiological response to life threat. But coming out of it, you need to go through whatever the action was that was aborted. Like the bird who flies in the window, falls on the deck, then you say, oh, he's concussed. No, he froze. And then he stands up and he shivers and shakes all over, just like he's flying. He completes the act of escape in his memory bank, so it's no longer there to keep coming up and causing those muscle groups to try to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he flies off, restored. And that concept of mitigation and completion of the freeze response is Levine's greatest contribution to the whole idea of trauma.
Well, maybe that leads us to Chapter 8 on healing your wounded brain and body, as the title of that chapter or key.
Right.
In the time that remains, maybe you could take us through the highlights of just how we would go about healing our wounded brain and body.
Well, the wounded body has to do with all of the medical syndromes that occur in people who have stored all this threat-based memory in their unconscious brain that keeps coming up and throwing them into fight-flight. And so there are a whole bunch of diseases that have to do with both the freeze response and the fight-flight response. And the freeze response is a time when the gut is active. You know, the soldier in the trench who empties his bowels and bladder in terror, he's in the freeze response, which is densely parasympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And this reptilian nucleus, the dorsal vagal nerve, is the thing that determines the freeze response. It's a devastating place to be in, and it accounts for most of the syndromes that we call somatization disorders, the cultural diseases that we all seem to have, and that's irritable bowel syndrome, ulcerative colitis, gastroesophageal reflux disease, fibromyalgia. All of these syndromes have to do with a sustained low-grade freeze response. So the freeze is dangerous to your health, basically. So what do you want to do? Everything is still driven by these procedural memories. So what you want to do is extinguish them, because the procedural memories are conditioned responses. So how do we do that? Well, we have to elicit or bring up the event that we want to extinguish. But if you do that, it throws you right into the fight-flight response. So to what you want to do. And what drives a fight-flight response is the amygdala, which a lot of people have heard that term. It's the arousal center in our emotional brain that allows us to evaluate information and then respond successfully by fight or flight. Or, if necessary, give up and go into a freeze. Well, the amygdala is what perpetuates trauma. All the cues that are stored in our unconscious body memory, when you get an external cue and triggers them, then that arouses the amygdala. And then we go right back into the PTSD symptom, the trauma symptom, the arousal, or again into another freeze, which we call dissociation. And dissociation is what we call what how we feel and how we behave during the freeze. So we need to find a way of accessing the cues that are in our memory bank for trauma while turning off the amygdala, somehow switching it off.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great place for us to wrap it up. There's so much more that we could talk about, and I've really found this to be a fascinating conversation. Dr. Robert Scheer, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my pleasure, David. Thank you.
I hope you found my conversation with Dr. Robert Scheer stimulating. Clearly, with a topic this technical and complex, we could have had a much longer discussion. As you heard, I was particularly excited by the way he has been able to correlate his knowledge of brain structure and function with such things as Jung's notion of a genetic collective unconscious, with EMDR and EFT, with certain shamanic practices, and with Reichian work, among others. I think this kind of integrative synthesis is really vital for the future progress of our understanding. Even though his name is pronounced Scheer, and the topic he's dealing with is so inherently complex, you should not be scared off. As he indicated, he wrote the book with curious, intelligent adults in mind, and I know that's a good description of my listenership. He does, in fact, present the material in a very comprehensive way without sacrificing the detail necessary for true understanding of these complex processes. I do recommend the book. It is available in paperback, and if you'd like a copy for yourself or someone else, may I suggest you use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Can you imagine your world without Shrink Wrap Radio? If you've become addicted to the show and you need your Dr. Dave psychology fix on a regular basis, then you have to, need to, got to go to the website and click on the big green donate button. The more you donate, the better you'll feel. It's easy and gratification is instant.
Thank you, loving and devoted sister Sherry West. And thanks to all of you who have helped to support this show through your donations. And if you haven't done so yet, won't you join those who have? I'm happy to announce a strategic alliance between Shrink Wrap Radio and two other web portals with similar interests. They are the Depth Psychology Alliance and the Jung Platform. There is a new page on the Shrink Wrap Radio site called Partners, and you'll find it under the Promos tab. Rather than competing with one another, we will be looking for ways to cross-promote and help one another. You can see the media release on the Partners page on our site to find out more about this. So, here's the first benefit of our collaboration. The Jung Platform has been producing high-quality audio and video lectures from major Jungian thinkers, some of whom I've interviewed here. And they are offering Shrink Wrap Radio listeners a 25% discount on all the lectures on their Jung Platform site. Now, this discount applies whether the lectures are on audio DVD or a video DVD or are streamed over the internet. Now, these are teaching lectures rather than interviews. So even though you may have heard me interview a person, you may still be interested in hearing one of their lectures because different material is likely to be highlighted. The focus is more on teaching. So, for example, among others, they have audio lectures by Michael Mead and Robert Wagner, both of whom I've interviewed here. If you end up taking advantage of the 25% offer, you'll also be helping out Shrink Wrap Radio because we'll get a small percentage of the sale. So go to the link in the right-hand sidebar for more information and to learn the discount code to use when you order audio lectures from the Jung platform. As time goes on, you can expect to see other forms of collaboration between the Depth Psychology Alliance, the Jung platform, and Shrink Wrap Radio. I must say, my trip to Sweden has thrown off my interview schedule a bit. As a result, you're getting this episode a bit later than usual, and I'm afraid there's going to be another gap because I'm going to be going to Montreal to give a presentation about Google Plus to the Market Research Association, of which I'm a member. That's one of the other hats I wear, you may recall. So this will be the last podcast before I leave on October 1st, and then I won't be back until October 11. And I know it will take me some time to get reoriented and get back on my interviewing schedule after that. So I ask for your kind indulgence during this coming hiatus. It'll be a good chance for you to go listen to back episodes you might not have heard or want to review. By the way, I have some walking around days in Montreal, and if any of you are in Montreal and would like to get together for coffee or a chat or walk around, please send me an email right away. And I'll also be monitoring my emails while I'm in Montreal.
You should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. And I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio. ShrinkWrapRadio.com.
Thank you for that plug, Adam Curry, also known as the Podfather, because he more or less invented podcasting. Well, it's been a while since we've had time to read some emails from our listener community, so let's catch up on a little recent email. First, we hear from naturopathic doctor and acupuncturist Ralph Wood Wilson, who in part writes, "Hey, David, I've been listening to your podcast while I drive my friend's car out to a mountain property in West Virginia to help clean up his cabin for planned use in youth outdoor programs. Thanks for making them of such good quality. I've listened to your interview with Dr. Criswell 3 times now. I featured your work and her work on my recent blog posting." You can find his blog at http://naturalworldhealing.com. He says, "Then I tweeted about it too. For the blog, I got creative and cut and pasted a somewhat fuzzy image of your logo. May I have a crisp copy of your logo? I placed a link from the logo to your website." Hey, I'm always happy to provide my logo to anybody who wants to help promote the show. Thanks a lot. He goes on to say, "Your podcasts are a definite encouragement to dig deeper into the available knowledge that can help me be more effective as a licensed naturopathic physician in engendering life changes in people in both their physical and their mental aspects. Thanks so much for your excellent interviews that touch upon the importance of the physical aspect of our lives. Aloha from here, Ralph." Ralph, thanks for this communication along with the others that you've sent me, and thanks for helping to make Shrink Wrap Radio visible to more people out there. Next, we hear from Don, who writes, "Dr. Dave, being an avid listener, I'm always impressed with the wide range of guests who you manage to find. I often wonder how you come up with all the ideas. I'm an IT guy, and the other day I was listening to Moira Gunn on Tech Nation, and she had a very interesting interview with two psychologists named Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels, of all things non-technical. I really enjoyed their talk and immediately thought of your show. Moira Gunn is a very good interviewer and with a technical mindset. However, I began thinking that your style would lead these gentlemen down a completely different path. Have you ever heard of the book The Tools, which they co-wrote? It addresses some of the issues you bring up concerning positive psychology, yet they have a different approach. By the way, I was a little hesitant to write, as I still owe you a transcript. Thanks sincerely, Don. Don, Moira Gunn is one of my favorite interviewers. I used to listen to her a lot on the radio. Now I don't listen to the radio anymore. I only listen on my iPhone to podcasts and audiobooks. I imagine I could get her on my, I'm sure she's got a podcast version, so I probably should add it to my list. And I had not heard of The Tools. I'll look into it. And, hey, now I've outed you in public, so get me that transcript. Okay. Next, we hear from Cheryl, who wrote in response to my thanks for her donation. Hi, David. I've been meaning to donate for a while now. I discovered your podcast a couple months ago, and I have been eating it up. Thank you so much for the wonderful content. I look forward to donating again in the parentheses near, close parentheses, future. Best regards, Cheryl. Well, it's great to hear from new listeners and also from new donors, and so I certainly thank you for that. Next, we hear from Oscar, my friend in Sweden, who was in my dream workshop, and he writes, David, thanks for a great weekend. I was busy yesterday, had to run some urgent errands at the university to ensure getting my student loan this month, and so there was no time nor energy to meet up with you before you left. We had hoped to meet up my last day. So he's referring to the fact that that didn't work out. I was impressed by your relaxed yet focused leading style and also by how you handled the emotional situations that arose in the group. It reminded me that it is not so much the therapist's techniques that make the difference, but his personality and the degree of I'm okay, you're okay that emanates from him or her. I had a dream the night after Sunday, that is the last, that Sunday being the last day of our workshop. He says, I had a dream the night after Sunday that sealed my workshop process. I felt safe and healed when I awoke from it. I hope we will meet again. As I said, I have a yearning to be back, to visit back to the Bay Area. So one never knows. It is exactly 4 years since I left Sweden for California. And if you feel like giving a new workshop here, be it about dreams, yoga, or other personal growth areas, always feel welcome to Sweden. All my best, Oscar. And I really appreciate getting this warm and affirming note from Oscar, who is quite an extraordinary person in his own right. Next, we hear from Torley, who writes, friendly greetings, Dr. Dave. Wanted to write in and compliment you on your long-running podcast. The audio quality is great, and I really have been enjoying and soon re-listening to your series of interviews with Jerry Trumbull about dreams. Dreams are vital to my music-making process, and I've been eager to learn more about hypnagogia, lucid dreams, and other related phenomena. I also work in virtual reality, Second Life, and was delighted to hear both of you mention it. What a great surprise. Are you planning to do any more interviews with Jerry in the near future? The both of you have a great rapport. Your back-and-forth chemistry is wonderful. Thanks so much for continuing your mission of sharing insights into the mind, and rock on. And that was from Torley Linden, who is who I think maybe works for Second Life or has worked for them. I think the name Linden is a Second Life name. And he's quite an extraordinary person himself, and very he's into a wide range of activities. And as you heard, he's a musician and has done extraordinary things on Second Life. Very interesting person. Blogger, has an extensive blog about Second Life. I think you can find him if you do a Google search on Torley Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N. And yes, I definitely want to have Jerry back on the show. I don't know how soon, but we do have great fun together. Next, we hear from a listener and donor who wishes to remain anonymous, who writes in part, "Hello, David, I'm writing from Australia because I found your radio show and Wise Counsel podcast recently. I finished a long-term therapy 6 months ago and was looking for a way to continue being therapeutically engaged and stimulated. Your show bridged that gap for me, and I'm so grateful to you for that gift and blessing. It's interesting that finding your radio show coincided with my leaping across another divide, a technological one that I was hesitant and shy about crossing. But with a timely gift from my Intune husband, an iPod Nano, which I affectionately call it my nanny, a kind of caring companion, I have been able to receive your shows and enjoy them very much. I like the wide range of guests and topics you cover, and especially appreciate the exploration of ideas and sense of intimacy and care that comes through the listening. Both your listening to your guests and me listening to the two of you talk. I think of your podcasts as conversations, and the way you do your podcasts makes them a rich experience." So thank you very much, anonymous listener and donor. That's so affirming, and I'm so glad to have you on as a listener and hope to keep up with the qualities that you appreciate. And finally, here's one more from Australia. I seem to have many wonderful listeners in Australia. And she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm hooked on your show and I'm enjoying your interviews a lot," and "a lot" is capitalized. "They make my daily travel to and from work rather short nowadays. I've only recently learned about your shows. Brandon Dennis pointed me in your direction." Ah, my friend and collaborator in New Zealand. "And then I discovered the fact that modern technology allows me to listen to you and learn while I drive. All of this already feels like a great discovery and has enriched my life. I love your shows on Jungian psychology, was very impressed with Maggie Phillips, and have been on fire after listening to your two shows with Ruben Nyman. Having trouble sleeping myself at times, it was incredibly useful and reassuring for me to hear Dr. Nyman's views on sleep and dreams and being awake. Fascinating. I also loved the neuropsychology interviews and was very impressed with Mark Solms. When listening to your shows, I find myself getting all excited about the world and the things we find out about ourselves as a species and the way we are connected with the world around us. I am a student of process work and have enjoyed listening to the interviews with Amy and Arnie Mindell, Julie Diamond, and Max Schupbach, and wonder if it would be possible to hear more from them or other process workers like Gary Reese or Lane Arye, to name just two. I want to say thank you. I'm looking forward to more of your fabulous interviews and teachings that come from them. All the very best to you from Victoria, Australia, Ricky." Ricky, thanks so much for that. And thanks for pointing me to these two process workers, Gary Reese and Lane Arye, that I have not previously heard of. So I'll have to put them on my very long to-do list. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Robert Scare, about how the brain handles trauma and PTSD. I'm not sure who my next guest will be. We'll all just have to be in suspense. So, until my return from Montreal, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.